Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and it is time for our weekly Q&A with Layla, a midsummer edition of Q&A with Layla, wherein we answer your questions. A lot of people are away on vacation, chilling out, but we keep churning along. You keep sending questions, so we're here to field them. Radio program at AOL.com is the destination for questions. Radio program at AOL.com. Email us your questions, and we'll attempt to answer them. Today with us, of course, Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mudin. She is a registered dietitian, the good kind, the kind that doesn't just dispense a jiggling bowl of Jell-O to you on your hospital bed.
Or Ensure.
or cans of Ensure. She also has an advanced master's degree in the field of nutrition, so she knows better. This week, first of all, how are you doing, Layla?
I'm okay, Dr. Hoffman. How are you? Enjoying the summer.
Enjoying the summer. And, yeah. I'm busily preparing for a triathlon. I haven't done a triathlon in a couple of years because, I got a little behind the eight ball in my training and decided not to punish my body too much, but I'm feeling it. I'm feeling it this year. Maybe it has to do with the fact that I inaugurated a Whole 30 diet program and, dropped a little weight and, a little less in the way of muscle soreness that's sometimes associated with high levels of training. And I'm feeling it. I'm feeling good. Hopefully, that'll last until next month when I, embark on that 1.3-kilometer swim. That's 0.9 miles with a 24-mile bike ride followed by a 6-mile run. I hope I got it in the tank, but we'll see. We'll see.
Dr. Hoffman, what would you say is the most difficult part, the bike ride, the running, or the swim?
I would say...
I think it's the swim.
For me, I'm a pretty good swimmer. I'm not a really fast swimmer. I'm a stolid, confident swimmer.
Yeah.
And, you know, the tough part about the swim is actually the scariness of the swim because, first of all, it's in open water. A lot of people are used to, you know, churning up and down pool lanes. You know, they're well regulated.
Yeah.
And in the open water, you know, lane markers. You have to sight towards a goal. You have to swim towards a goal. And the water can sometimes be choppy. You wear a wetsuit, which helps you swim, actually, but some people are not used to. They find it an encumbrance. Also, there's a lot of people in the water. So it's kind of like, I liken it to, like a sea of thrashing piranhas when you get into the water. You know, there's a lot of people swimming up your back or, you know, smacking into you.
Getting kicked,
you know, and there's this little bit of a struggle in the water, especially in the beginning as you, you know, find your room to swim in. And that also creates a higher potential for dying. Actually, I don't want to get morbid about it.
Really,
interestingly, you would think that people drop dead at sort of the end of the race, you know, where they're really exhausted. But actually, because of the elevated heart rate and excitement of the beginning of the race and the chaos of that swim, that's where sometimes less fit athletes or older athletes sometimes get a heart attack. And there have been some deaths during the swim portion, rarely during the bicycling portion or the run portion. But so for me, the toughest part, unquestionably, is the run because I'm not, such a stalwart runner at almost 64. I mean, I've been running for many, many years. But one tends to slow down. I mean, that's why professional athletes, you don't see a lot of, you know, you see some occasionally like a 40-year-old like Big Poppy, Ortiz for Boston having the best year of his life at 40. But he's aching. He's hurting. And he says that, he's definitely going to retire after this year. I got 24 years on him. So, you know, something, especially when you train hard, something's going to, you know, slow you down a little bit. Some stiffness here, some soreness there. So the tough part is running after you have spent at least 2 hours at a high level of exertion, and then you've got to run. So it's not like a cold run, you know, where you strap on your sneakers and, you know, you run out of your you know, apartment or you run out of your driveway and hit the road, it's you've already been, you know, hammering pretty hard.
Yeah.
So, you know,
and it's 6 miles, right? The run.
And it's 6 miles, which really is, yeah, which really is not, a huge run, you know, because you run marathons. And of course, the end of an Ironman, which is really nuts, is a marathon. You literally run a marathon at the end of like 6 hours of exercise. But the part, it's psychological. It's sort of like you're tired and you just have to keep reaching into that reserve to just say, keep on putting one foot in front of the other, maintain your form, you know, try and run fluid and relaxed when your body is telling you enough already. You want to really slow down. So that, yeah. Undoubtedly is the hard. Also, these races start very early in the morning. This one will start at 6:20 in the morning. But, what'll happen is, it gets warmer, especially in the month of August. And you're going to have a really, serious potential for, you know, overheating and dehydration as the sun comes up, because the slower contestants, I mean, the real champion contestants, they can do the whole thing in 2 hours. But, ordinary mortals, you know, we're going to do it 3 hours plus. That means more time on the course and it heats up. And then it's, you know, you have to contend with, your resistance to heat.
Well, Dr. Hoffman, it seems like you're really, really well prepared. So best of luck to you. Wow.
Thank you very much.
You know, that could be an entire podcast about how you get ready for that.
Yeah,
how you eat, the supplements you take, all of that kind of thing.
Yeah, I wasn't going to do that until I actually accomplished it. You know, because, I mean,
you've done triathlons before, so, you know.
Yeah, I'm very used to it. I feel, you know, very confident that I can be doing it, you know, unless some unforeseen injury comes up for me. Okay, so let's proceed to questions. We have listener questions, so let's tackle those.
Yes, we do. We've got an email from Lori. Hi, Dr. Hoffman and Layla. You asked for feedback on some of the supplements you talk about. First, let me say that many years ago you spoke about magnesium helping with heart palpitations and headaches. Before I took your advice and started taking magnesium taurate, and the palpitations and headaches are gone, pretty much.
Wow, that's excellent.
Now,
that's great to hear.
Yeah, I did have a full cardio workup, and the cardiologist actually told me that the slight irregularity in my heartbeat was less detrimental than the drugs he would prescribe for me.
Yes.
Now that's pretty forward thinking, wouldn't you say?
Yeah. No, so let me comment on that.
That was all before. All before starting magnesium.
Let me comment on that. Is that arrhythmias are, you know, our heart irregularities are of two or three basic types. You know, there are some that are disconcerting. And particularly in some individuals, they're very, very, they really, drive them nuts, because it's just very disconcerting to feel these things. Some people have a little more visceral awareness. They're more attuned to what's happening within their chests and in their digestive tract and in their bodies. Particularly highly sensitive patients with mitral valve prolapse, I've noticed have that. You really need to get checked out when this happens, but doctors can divide arrhythmias into two categories, benign and potentially dangerous. So a benign arrhythmia means that you feel an occasional skip, but it's not consequential. It's not going to lead to a catastrophic problem, such as, you know, arrhythmias can sometimes, ventricular arrhythmias can cause sudden death. You know, even without a blood clot in a coronary artery, if you go into ventricular tachycardia, you can die. And that's the, you know, scary part, and gets people very apprehensive. But an atrial arrhythmia with an occasional skip beat is not a big problem.
Yeah.
Another type of atrial arrhythmia that's more serious is atrial fibrillation, especially when you go in and out. And the risk there is that because of the turbulence that's set up inside your heart, you can get a blood clot. And the blood clot then gets ejected from your heart chamber upwards into your carotid arteries, which can then lead to a stroke. That's a common cause of a stroke, especially in a young person, even without severe atherosclerosis or high cholesterol, or, you know, so much in the way of cardiovascular risk. So I think doctors can play a role to say, let's do halter monitor. That's you walk around with a monitor, or you can use an event monitor, and they carefully look at the tracing, and they'll tell you, look, there's just an occasional skip beat. It's nothing to worry about. You know, occasionally they'll give you aspirin as a preventive. But even aspirin has consequences. And these medications that slow the heart, they'll give you beta blockers, calcium channel blockers. They all have side effects. So, you know, I'm glad that the doctor is using a light hand with us. I mean, it's not necessarily something that needs to be treated with medication. And, you know, by the way, this is not the first time we've gotten an email from someone, who says that just based on listening to us, they've taken magnesium for, heart, skip beats, regular beats, and they've gotten improvement. So this, we see this, of course, in daily practice. That's routine for us, but, it's nice that people are getting a benefit from just listening to the broadcast. So, okay. Right. Let's keep going on that one.
So, Lori says, after your show on PQQ, pyroloquinolone quinone, I did buy it and I started taking it, and I noticed soon after that I started having heart palpitations again. Well, I stopped the PQQ and the palpitations stopped. Now, Dr. Hoffman, the difference between PQQ and CoQ10 is that PQQ can stimulate the growth of fresh mitochondria.
Okay.
As opposed to CoQ10 providing energy, right?
Okay.
What do we think happened to Lori with the PQQ?
I'm not sure there is a correlation. You know, when we hear of side effects, as you know, we hear a lot of people say, I took this and I got a twitch in my pinky, you know.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I'm just making that up. Correlation is not necessarily causation. There are some things which typically can cause certain side effects. So we can predict that. So we can say, oh, wow, you took this and you felt hyper. Okay, well, we do see a certain percentage of patients who feel hyper when they take certain things, not necessarily PQQ, but a certain supplement. That makes sense.
It's almost like a paradoxical reaction to some degree.
Right, and then there are these reactions which are idiosyncratic, where it's like, wow, you are unique in that you have this reaction. So we don't discount that possibility that PQQ might cause palpitations, but what we'd have to do is rigorously test it out. You have to make sure that you stop it, and it's hopefully it'll get better, and then you restart it, and then it happens again, and then you maybe do it two or three times. That's the scientific method. Mm-hmm. You know, you never prove a scientific theorem based on a single experiment. They say, okay, great, we found that this in one study, something happened.
Right.
And then they say scientists all over the world are going to read a medical journal, and they're going to say, great, let me try it in my lab, and I can see if I can replicate it. And sometimes they'll say, no, you know, that's a quirk. Your lab found that this happened, that this principle is valid, but we could not replicate that. So I would take a scientific approach to that. I can't tell you that you're imagining it or that it's not the case for you individually, but PQQ generally is not a stimulant that can make your heart race. It really shouldn't, in my opinion. Also, we don't know that much about PQQ, by the way. PQQ is a relatively new supplement. We don't know that much about it.
Right. If you're going to use a scientific method, I wonder if Lori, at the same time as starting PQQ, also started drinking coffee or having an afternoon cup of tea or...
Yeah. Yeah. You know, by saying we don't know that much about PQQ, I mean we as a scientific and nutritional community don't know that much about PQQ. It's, you know, Layla and I are trying to stay abreast of all new developments. We don't use PQQ that much in the practice at the Hoffman Center. But it could be a nutrient that could really help, especially neurodegenerative disease. It's part of what we discussed when we talked to Dr. Dale Bredesen, who is formulating an anti-Alzheimer's program that comprises lifestyle, diet, exercise, stress reduction, proper sleep, detoxification, but also certain key supplements. He has some supplements that he favors.
All right. Well, Lori, best of luck to you. Okay. We've got an email from Larry. Larry writes, Dear Dr. Ron and Layla, can you please talk about the disadvantages of drinking soy milk. Okay, well.
The way you said it, it almost sounded like, could you talk about the disadvantages of drinking? But we're not talking about alcohol. We're talking about soy milk. So
soy can have a lot of disadvantages, as we know.
So, yeah.
First of all, it's probably the biggest goitrogen. So for any... yeah, we're talking about soy milk. Yeah, you know. Well, you could take a bath in soy milk. I don't know if there are any disadvantages there. But, okay, soy is a goitrogen. That's number one. Soy also introduces a lot of phytoestrogens, but you know, the milk form of soy, typically when you're picking up soy milk, it may be GMO. There may be the addition of carrageenan in its ingredients. Carrageenan can be a troublemaker for those, especially with compromised GI tracts, whether it's IBS or ulcerative colitis or inflammatory bowel disease or
right.
Something like that. So that could be something.
Certainly in terms of digestibility, there are indigestible compounds in soy that render it gassy and bloating for some people. It also is rich in the isoflavones, genistein and diadsin, mm-hmm. which are have a hormonal effect. And so
they do.
And that may be protective in some settings against prostate cancer, mm-hmm. for example, but it may also be in some settings promotional in, say, estrogen receptor positive cancers. So
yeah.
Whether it's a blocker or an accentuator still is controversial. And I'm not one of these people, and you're not one of these people I know from talking to you, is that some people believe that soy is like the mark of the devil. You know, it's like the cross to the vampire. It's like never soy. You know, like the never Hillary, never Trump. You know, it's no never soy.
Right.
For some individuals, that makes sense. For other individuals, modest consumption of soy is fine. And
yeah.
But so the thing about soy milk is that soy milk is a refined product. It concentrates the soy. And I think a preferable way to consume soy, in my opinion, is just consume edamame.
Edamame.
Or perhaps fermented soy products like tempeh or tofu in moderation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In moderation. Yeah. So, Larry, thank you for your question. Right. Let's see here. We've got an email from Charlie. Do you have any suggestions for pre- and post-op back surgery? I love your podcast and try to listen every day. Thank you, Charlie, for listening.
That is so great.
Yeah, yeah. So for any surgery, not just back surgery, you want to make sure you're in the best possible health. You want to up your protein sources and make sure, and after surgery, you know, as a dietitian, one of the first things after surgery is to be on a bit of a higher protein diet because you need those amino acids for healing.
Mm-hmm. Right. And the other thing I would say is, if possible, if you have elective surgery, is to
As far as supplements.
To prehab as opposed to rehab. You know, in other words, do something that will, and it's tough if you're going to be headed for back surgery. You can't do a lot of exercise, but you could get into a pool and walk, because anytime you enhance circulation, you're going to increase the likelihood of a proper surgical recovery. So that I think is, if it's elective surgery, try to build yourself up a little bit before the surgery. Go ahead, Layla.
Yeah. Yeah. No, exactly that. And I know the IVs, we have pre and post IVs. You know, one thing that really goes down in the setting of a trauma like that, any surgery is trauma, is magnesium.
Yes.
That's a big one.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Absolutely.
There.
Well, okay, so
we
actually have a section that is supplements for surgery, and we can reiterate those, but, it's best to probably go to our section if you go to drhoffman.com, we have several articles on supplements for surgery. And we have a little search box there. If you just put in supplements for surgery, you'll find the article. It's a comprehensive list. A lot of people are, copying that list. It's a PDF, and they are taking the supplements that are helpful. The supplements to really avoid, obviously, things that could thin the blood.
Let's talk about that, the blood-thinning supplements,
Yeah, which ones would you tell people to hold off on?
I would normally tell people to stop taking fish oil. About a week before surgery, stop taking fish oil or flax oil if they're taking a supplement. I would have them stop taking ginkgo biloba, possibly garlic, because it can have a blood-thinning effect. Any natokinase, if they're on aspirin therapy, they should probably stop that as well.
Right.
And high amounts of vitamin E, if they're taking a lot of vitamin E, say 800 IU maybe.
And by the way,
I don't know, Dr. Hoffman, what do you think?
I think that when they tell you to stop taking vitamin E altogether, that's a mistake, because it's actually been shown, and I write this in the article, that smaller amounts of vitamin E, more physiological amounts like 100, 200, do not cause blood thinning, but actually enhance the immune response and are helpful for repair. So when they tell you stop taking everything, what they're doing is they're denying you the support that you need for proper repair. I've not had a lot of surgery in my life, but I did break my leg, and there involved surgery. I broke my hip, and I took intravenous vitamin C for 20 or 25 days right after I came back from the hospital.
Terrific.
I think that really helped the healing process. Mm-hmm. And, I healed marvelously. That's one of the reasons why I'm still able to, after a hip fracture, was able to get back out and, resume my athletic career. Things that, that help, we also want to, if it's a bone surgery, we might suggest, something like Ostinol for repair of the bone. But, this is a back surgery, so generally it's not cutting into bone a lot. There will be a little bit of slicing and dicing there. I will say this, though. I have to say, I'm not a big fan of back surgery, and I think back surgery should rarely be undertaken. I think only in the most extreme circumstances is back surgery warranted, because it usually results in short-term amelioration of the pain, but long-term, you just have to keep having more and more back surgeries. I have some relatives, and they were lovely people, and but they don't get it about this type of medicine, alternative medicine. There's doctors in the family, and they really subscribe to conventional medicine. And one by one, I look at Facebook and it's like, oh, I'm going for back surgery again. It's like each one of them has had multiple back surgeries. They really believe in the surgery, that the surgery is going to fix them. But, a couple years later,
they wouldn't have to keep going back if it fixed them.
A couple of years later, it's like they fix one area and then the problem tracks upwards. And if they just, did some more of the right, rehab and stretching, and were on a really clean diet that's anti-inflammatory, they would have far less in the way of back problems, in my opinion.
Oh, and I want to mention, Charlie can restart those blood-thinning supplements probably about a week after surgery. After that visit with the surgeon, after the surgery, and everything is good and all of that kind of thing. That's usually a week later or so, I would think. Maybe 10 days in some cases, but...
Great.
Okay.
All right, well, we have to pause because we divide these
podcasts
into two parts. Let's give us a little tease to what we're going to discuss in part two.
I want to know, what can I do? I feel fatigued all the time.
Oh, sounds like
that's a consult.
That's a consult at the Hoffman Center. But we can touch upon that next time in part two of today's Intelligence Medicine Podcast. It's our weekly Q&A with Layla. Please join us for part two. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman.